There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do you and I enter into the conversations of the day as the very ambassadors of Jesus Christ? We've been hearing a lot about an ambassador from Russia this week, and today I want you to think about yourself in your role as an ambassador of Jesus Christ. Are you speaking the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Have you spent enough time in the Word cultivating the mind of Christ so that you can literally know what the will of God is in a certain circumstance? You can immediately draw to mind the biblical principle that should be lifted up in the context of any conversation that's taking place. I think we have to face it that people do not need merely another piece of our mind. They need the very piece of the mind of Christ. So I invite you to connect with us online. We have some new resources posted for you today at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. So a couple of days ago, I referenced a horrific story about a church in a so-called church. It's not a church, but they use the word church in describing themselves, and they probably use the tax-exempt status of church. So they're technically a church, but they're not a church in North Carolina. I shared with you that horrific story of the way they have been treating people for decades, physically abusing, psychologically abusing, and even overlooking the sexual abuse of their members. It was a horrific story. And what breaks my heart is that one of our listeners simply replied saying, "That's my story." And I want to say to you, that's, my heart breaks that the church has not only stood idly by, but actively participated in abuse, neglect. And I want to reach out in the context of today's commentary and just say to you, if you are in a relationship that's not safe, if you are in a church where you are experiencing abuse, if you are in a relationship where you are experiencing abuse, I want you to reach out, and I want you to get the help that you deserve. You are a priceless, precious child of God. I've got a domestic violence hotline that you can call. It's 1-800-799-SAFE. That number is 1-800-799-SAFE. That's S-A-F-E. If you are in a situation where someone is hurting you, where someone is treating you as less than the child of God you are, as less than priceless and precious and worth it to God, that He would come from heaven to earth in the person of Jesus Christ and give His life as a willing sacrifice to save yours. I want you to reach out and get out of the situation that you're in. And I'm going to challenge the church to prepare itself to be ready to receive those who the world might view as damaged and discardable, and we need to recognize as precious and redeemed. I interviewed a woman this week. Her name's Autumn Miles. Her interview will air here on a later edition of The Reconnect. But one of the things that Autumn Miles said about the situation that I referred to in North Carolina, and also the situation that our first guest today, William Paul Young, experienced in his own life. That's her story. That's her experience. And that's what she said. She said, "That's my story." And then I pick up the paper today and I read this headline. "We have known men, former girl soldiers, suffer stigma back home." This is a Huffington Post story, and it is about these girls who are kidnapped from their tribal villages They are married off to rebel soldiers. The testimony of the woman in this particular article was 11 years old when she was taken. Her country has one of the highest rates of child soldiers in the world. An estimated 30,000 children at any given time are serving as child soldiers in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This has been going on since the early 1990s, and former child soldiers, the article says, who have been rescued or escape from the armed groups, they are very vulnerable to being re-recruited. Why? Because for many of them, the article says, life as a soldier is more appealing than the life they return to. Why is that? Because many return home to no access to services that would be aimed at helping them reintegrate. It leaves them exposed to discrimination and rejection by their communities. For girls, the article says, fitting in again once they're back home is especially difficult because it is assumed that they have been raped by their captors, and women, girls who have been held by these rebel groups are then often shunned by their families and communities. This article, Sophie, who's the 22-year-old featured in this article who was kidnapped when she was 11, says, we have known men. We are considered dirty. People do not even speak to us. She says, many have no choice but to go back to the bush, which means back to their captors. The article talks about the reality of these girls not having what you and I would consider a normal childhood. It says they haven't been to school. They haven't played ball in the yard. They haven't gone to church on Sunday. They've had routines, but not the routines that any children should ever have. I want us to pause for a moment. And I want us to thank God for just how routine our lives are. I want to thank God for the monotony of what some people consider the relentless return of the Sabbath, for every Sunday, for the rhythm of an ordered and an orderly life. I want to thank God for the routine of getting up and our kids being able to go to school every day, 5 days a week. I want us to thank God for the rhythm of freedom and safety in which they can go outside and play. I want us to thank God for the rhythm and the routine of the blessing of eating regular meals. I want us to thank God for the rhythm and the routine of mundane, ordinary, everyday life, because for a lot of people in the world, what you and I consider routine is anything but routine. They would consider it heaven. They would consider our lives likened to heaven on earth. Because, my friends, what they have experienced in hell is what they have experienced on earth is or are the routines of hell, not heaven. My first guest today, and this is going to be a recorded interview, and we don't have time to play the entirety of the recorded interview today, but I had the privilege of interviewing William Paul Young. William Paul Young is the person who wrote the book, The Shack. Now, that book tonight becomes a movie. It was a New York Times bestseller. More than 20 million people have read it. William Paul Young has quite a dramatic testimony, and he's going to share some of that with us in our conversation today. But let me just say that he was born in Canada. He was raised among what we would consider a Stone Age tribe. His parents were missionaries in the highlands of the former New Guinea. He suffered what I will describe as great loss, and he will tell you what that was. But the movie airs tonight, begins tonight, and it's called The Shack, and a lot of people are going to read it, and you are going to hear a lot of criticism of it from conservative Christians. And what I am interested in you being prepared to do is to talk with people who have seen the film and who have been touched by it. Because simply to criticize the theology of it doesn't help the people whose pain is laid bare by this film and who are going to need you to walk with them from the exit of the film where they have witnessed a person having a transforming encounter with God and they will now be longing for their own healing and reconciliation. And Christians, you and I are just the people to do it. Here's my interview with William Paul Young.
Paul, welcome to the Reconnect. I am so honored to be with you. Thank you so much.
So I was pleased to have the opportunity to screen the film, so I'm excited to talk with you about it. Certainly this was true in the book. It is, I think, profoundly demonstrated in the movie that the pain, the abuse, the suffering, the evil, and the sin of the world is real. It weighs heavily on people. People really do walk around every day with the kind of experiences that Mac personifies. You articulate, and then the film personifies, just how isolating a phenomenon pain can be. So tell us, from your perspective, how The Shack sort of reflects the path of pain and redemption that people walk, and maybe that you've walked in your own life.
You can read the story of The Shack just as a story, as a parable, but it has very deep layers beneath that. For me personally, The Shack is the place I got stuck. It's my own broken heart, my own broken soul. And for a lot of us who grew up with great sadness, and I did, I am a first-born missionary kid, preacher's kid, in a modern evangelical context, and experienced a lot of great sadness growing up, some incredibly wrenching. And so the house on the inside was not built well. I didn't get good help. That then became the place where I stored my addictions and hid all my secrets and was so full of shame I didn't want anybody ever to find it, because I couldn't take the risk that I would see on their face the same look of disgust that I saw when I looked in the mirror. And that's one kind of loss. Because the book centers and the movie centers on the loss between a parent and a child, which I personally think is the greatest loss a human being can experience. It's the greatest loss that God has experienced in the loss of Jesus, in that sense, to death. I think it picks up all the other losses along the way. And that's partly why so many people from every kind of walk of life, whether a faith background or not, they really have an invitation into something that is profoundly human. And that is that we share love and we share loss. And it's all wrapped up inside questions about faith and God and what it means to be human and everything else. And this is what this film is about. This is what the book was about. It gave people, and continues to do so, a language, many for the first time, a language in which they can have a conversation about God that is relational and not religious.
So certainly there is this profound loss that Mac experiences as an adult, but there are a lot of losses in his life that he experiences as a child. And I think that the reconciliation, the thread of reconciliation throughout this film, Mac is not only reconciled to God, Mac is reconciled to himself. He's reconciled to his own father. He's reconciled in the context of his family that is still alive and needs him as a dad and a husband. He's even at some level reconciled to the church. His neighbor notes at the end of the film, I don't think I'm giving anything away, that every day there's this growing evidence of peace and joy and childlikeness. I guess I'm hoping that for you, you're experiencing that kind of integrated reality of redemption in your own life. Can you tell us what your journey has been like with
Sure.
the Lord since your own experience of reconciliation?
So when I wrote the section about chapter 15, which is Festival of Friends, about the reconciliation between Mackenzie and his dad, I wrote that as a hope. And I'm certain that that hope will be realized fully one day. But a lot of the damage that we grew up with, and one of mine is a very difficult relationship with my dad. He was a young, angry man on a mission who didn't have a chip for being a dad. His dad had so blasted that to bits before I ever showed up. But, you know, as a child, I didn't, and children don't have a capacity not to take the blame for things that are not right. And so my dad was a very angry, abusive disciplinarian. And that became a through line for Mackenzie. And when I wrote that chapter, it's not... My dad and I are still working on our testimony, as it were. But but it is a sure and certain hope that that reconciliation will ultimately be affected. So my great sadnesses revolve around sexual abuse on the mission field, both in the tribal culture and then at boarding school. Because in those days, you were sent away to boarding school at 5 or 6. And boarding school was not a safe place in those days. So it tears the fabric of the human soul apart. That's, again, the metaphor of the shack. And I drug that all with me throughout my whole life. My real work started in 1994 when I was exposed with a huge failure. I committed adultery. I had a three-month affair with one of my wife's best friends, and she caught me. I wasn't whole enough even to confess it. I got caught. And that started an 11-year process of dismantling pretty much everything I thought about who I was and who God was and rebuilding it. And it wasn't until there was a sense of integration, as you talked about, where finally I was the same person in every situation. I have no secrets and I have no addictions. And I finally have become a child. And that kind of integration, which is my reality now, was the most difficult, arduous, painful. I would never want to go through that again, but I'm grateful every day for the transformation of it. It's not that there isn't finished work, but the big reconstruction was done. It took Kim and I 11 years to heal. It took 11 years for me to start becoming the same person on the outside as existed on the inside. So that thread's there for a reason. When you got those statements at the end of the movie about Mackenzie, I'm talking about myself. To put it a different way, there was a writer in Nashville named Leanne Stewart who, when the book first came out, she sent me an email and she said, I have no idea who you are, because nobody really did. But my sense is that Missy, Mackenzie's daughter, represents something murdered in you as a child, probably your innocence. And Mackenzie is you as the adult trying to deal with it. And that is so true. Some of us are just so broken to the core of our being that exposure becomes the greatest gift, although it's also one of the greatest sorrows. But I'm living proof that you don't have to die before you come to some form of healing and integration. That Jesus meets us on this side and begins to work in the middle of all of our stuff to co-create something that is actually alive.
Well, one of the things that, Paul, you are certainly as aware of as I am, is that there's a fair measure of criticism from theologians in particular, but from, some other conservative Christians as well, criticisms of the book specifically. And yet, as I was watching the film, I thought I was aware that there are some important differences between the movie and the book that seem to me to avoid some of those most treacherous areas that folks had criticized. And I'm wondering if, from your perspective, there were intentional adaptations made from the book to the movie in order to alleviate some of that critical stress in the conservative Christian community.
What the Netters did, what Lionsgate did, and Stuart Hazeldine and the crew, is that they were trying to be a faithful adaptation. And I don't think they went really out of their way. They did make a couple adaptations in order to frame it so that folks who are my folks, because the criticism primarily comes from my own people, that is modern evangelical fundamentalists. I come from a holiness background, and I know what they're afraid of. Fundamentally, the truth is that most of the people who are upset with the book have not read it. I mean, I'm serious. I've even had protesters and gotten into conversations where nobody who was protesting had actually read the book. So, and even some big name people in my conversations with them, we've come to have this conversation that no, they didn't actually read the book. They just heard about it. And I get that because I grew up, I think Christians sometimes have an addiction to being right. And we forget that all of us are moving in this journey. We also forget that really major theologians absolutely support the orthodoxy of the Shack. And that includes, Southern Baptist and Lutheran and Catholic and Protestant. And, a really brilliant book is The Shack Revisited by Baxter Kruger, who's a theologian trained in Trinitarian theology at Aberdeen, in Aberdeen, Scotland. So, yes, a movie is different than a book. And of course, you can't go into the depth of the conversation, but it's there. All the elements that people raise as questions are also there inside the movie, but it does it in a way that doesn't get us stuck in our heads. And I think that's part of the issue. The Shack had the power to hit us in our hearts before our heads engaged. And then when our heads engaged, we felt this cognitive dissonance. the sense of stress. And I think the movie does a masterful job of calming some of that or presenting it in a way where you can see it rather than just get stuck in a mental exercise about it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I came away appreciating the dark night of the soul or the way that people can get stuck in the valley of the shadow of death and appreciating the appeal to God, the appeal of God to Mac as a precious child. And I think that if people today could have a transforming encounter with God where they really understood how much God loves them and how interested God is in their welfare and how interested God is in their life. And yes, interested in a fellowship during life, every day, in every moment, and a fellowship for all eternity. There are things that captured my attention in the movie that I won't give away here today, but I want to thank you for joining us on the Reconnect and for engaging in the conversation and for keeping the conversation open. I think that it's important for Christians to engage in cultural conversations of the day, even when those conversations can, for some of us, scratch right on the edge or in the middle of some theological conviction that we've been holding. And I think that you do that. I think that you provoke conversations that people need to be having. And you also, man, you just so effectively pull back the curtain on the ways in which sometimes the institutional church absolutely fails to meet people in their pain, to defend the powerless, to do the right thing at the right time, even if it's hard. I want to say that I appreciate the honesty of the film. And I certainly appreciated the way in which, you used the word frame. I like the way the movie is framed. And I won't tell people how that happens, but I like the way the movie is framed because it helps me be able to point to the personification of the Trinity and say, in this context, within this frame, I can understand how these characters appear in these ways. And that's particularly helpful for me, you know, as a person of a theological mindset who doesn't think that the Father or the Spirit, you know, are ever appropriately portrayed in human form. But I can understand in the framing of the film how it is appropriate. William Paul Young, thank you so much for joining us here today on The Reconnect. We look forward to future conversations. All right, friends, if you want to hear my full interview with the author of The Shack, the movie opens tonight, you can go to reconnectwithcarmen.com. We posted the full interview there for you. The other thing that you're going to find there today is a resource that I wrote for you to equip Christians to engage people in conversation about this movie. People are going to see this movie. I can almost guarantee it. And after people have gone to see this movie, they're going to tell other people to go to see this movie. Why? It is beautiful. It is painful. It is piercing. It's provocative. And so you and I better be equipped to talk about it. Why? People are going to come out of the movie, and the pain and the shame and the darkness and whatever shack it is that they got stuck in as a kid or as a young adult or as a man or a woman upon whom the evil of the world has been perpetrated. Anyone out there who is living with the shame and the pain and the brokenness of abuse of any kind or loss of any kind is going to be touched by this film. And the question is, are we as Christians going to be equipped to then have conversations with them that lead them to their own transforming encounter with the living and loving and grace-filled God, whom we know from the scriptures and by the power of the Holy Spirit through our own transformed lives now? So the Shack resource, available at reconnectwithcarmen.com, is designed to do just that. It's to help you as a Christian talk with other people who go to see the film. All right, friends, after the break, we're going to be right back here with Trevin Wax. It's going to be a great conversation about Christians who, operate more as lie detectors sometimes, or compliment people who just compliment everything than actually as Christians. So don't go anywhere. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Reconnect with your host, Carmen LaBurge. Now, back to Carmen.
Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're not only talking about what people are talking about, we're talking with the people about whom people are talking. And so today that means we're talking with Dr. Trevin Wax. Trevin is, he's a publisher for Lifeway Christian Resources. And the newest thing they've got out, which we're going to talk about at the end of this interview, because I got stuff I want to talk about first. But the thing we're going to talk about is the Christian Standard Bible. So I know you're thinking to yourself, okay, we need another Bible and we need another translation of the Bible. And these guys have done it. It's the Christian Standard Bible, the CSB. So we're going to add this to our alphabetical soup lexicon with the ESV and the NIV and all its other friends. All right, but here's some fun stuff about Trevin. He is a former missionary to Romania. He hosts a blog at the Gospel Coalition, which is one of the favorite places that I like to read him. He regularly contributes to a lot of great outlets like the Washington Post, the Religion News Service, Christianity Today, and World. And he's got a PhD in theology, and he's got a new book out. So I want to talk first about the new book, and the new book is This Is Our Time: Everyday Myths in Light of the Gospel. You can follow him on Twitter at Trevin Wax. Trevin, welcome to The Reconnect.
Glad to be with you, Carmen.
Okay, so I want to start with lie detector Christians and complementary Christians. Tell us about them and then tell us why this is our time.
You know, when we think about the worldviews that are out there in society, a lot of Christians, when we're analyzing our culture or we're thinking about what it means to be a faithful Christian, some Christians I call lie detector Christians, meaning they're able to spot the falsehoods in the myths that people believe, in the worldviews out in society. They immediately see where things fall short of the gospel, and they want to point those out to people to say, look, the gospel is right, and all of these other ways of living or these other ways of seeing the world are wrong. Then on the other side, you have complementary Christians who actually can see the deeper longings behind many of the worldviews that are in society, the reason why people would want certain things to be true. And complementary Christians, though, tend to not really want to challenge what people in our society may believe. Instead, they take some of those deeper longings that people have and they sort of baptize them with Christian language. And what I'm saying in This Is Our Time is neither one of those approaches will actually lead us to the best way to be faithful. We need a way that actually where we show how the gospel answers the deepest longings of our hearts, but also challenges the lies that are out there in our culture and in the different practices and habits and worldviews that we may adopt.
Okay, so just Wednesday, we had a clash between the lie detector Christians and the complementary Christians. And so for my listeners, I want to use Glitter Ash Wednesday as a way of being sure that you understand what Trevin is talking about. For those of you for whom the Glitter Ash Wednesday was immediately offensive, you knew immediately that there was something wrong with people adding glitter to the ashes on Ash Wednesday in order to raise public awareness about LGBTQ people and their concerns. On the flip side, obviously it was Christians who were doing it. And so they are, in essence, baptizing something that a group of people very much want to have be embraced as a part of Christian life. And so they are essentially using something that is very sacred to some Christians, the practice of putting ashes on your forehead on Ash Wednesday and commemorating not only the death of Jesus, but the reality of the depth of sin and brokenness in our own lives, and then beginning the journey of Lent in that way towards the passion of the Christ. So on Wednesday, we had the lie detector Christians screaming their heads off that this is wrong. This is so contrary to what should be happening, but not being able to recognize there's obviously a really deep brokenness that needs to be dealt with here for folks who think this is okay. And on the flip side, those who are baptizing what clearly the scripture says is not okay. So what I'm doing there, Trevin, is trying to help my people see what you're talking about. So if you could then tell us why this is our time, what does that mean?
Well, when we talk about this particular generation and this cultural moment that we're in, I think it's important for us to recognize that God has called us to be faithful now. A lot of people are up in arms about the different challenges that we're facing. They may be discouraged, or they may be demoralized, or they may feel just frustrated and uncertain and confused about what is faithfulness going to look like in a world where the culture is changing so rapidly. And one of the things I'm wanting to do through the book is to say, okay, let's step back and let's take a look. The title has a double meaning. This is our time. Throughout the book, I'm showing chapter by chapter, from smartphone use to Hollywood, to how we conceive of the purpose of life, to our shopping habits and consumerism, our political involvement, sex, marriage, all these things. And I'm saying, look, let's take a snapshot, several snapshots of our culture in this particular moment, and realize this is the time in which we are called to be faithful. These are the people we are called to reach. And then the second part of that meaning of that title, this is our time, like you were saying, is because it's important for us to realize when we are begrudgingly obeying, or feeling like our faithfulness is like we're almost, we resent some of the challenges that we may be facing in this generation, we're questioning the goodness and the sovereignty of God. No, God has given us this moment at this time. We are surrounded. We are on the racetrack, surrounded by the great cloud of witnesses who are cheering us on. And this is our time to run the race. And so I want Christians to feel equipped to meet the challenges of this moment and to realize this is the adventure of being a Christian. There's no sense in being sort of gloomy and despairing. We have a God whose son came out of the grave. And I think that's the one thing that we have to go back to again and again to give us hope in the time that we live in.
Okay, so wait a second. Christianity is not just a private faith thing that I do on the side of everything else, sort of out of sight. What? I'm letting you confront it, man. I'm letting you confront the private nature of it.
A lot of people want Christianity to be private, to be personal, and that fits really well in our day and age when everyone thinks, you know, let's let science and technology and all of these things run the world, and then if you really want to have a religious experience on your own, that's fine for you, but don't bring that out into public life. As Christians, we cannot go along with that. We believe that the world fundamentally changed when Jesus Christ walked out of the grave, and so we worship a crucified and risen king. For people who would say Christianity is not political at all, I would say, well, okay, it depends on how you define politics, I guess, but we worship a king. You can't get more political than that, right? That we actually believe that we belong to a kingdom that transcends the borders of our nation, that is worldwide, global, that we have more in common with a believer in Iran than we do with an unbelieving next-door neighbor who we may grill out with, right? That at the fundamental level of what we have in common the most, the blood of Jesus Christ, is the most foundational aspect of our being. This goes much deeper than just something that can be put in the pocket or it be kept in the privacy of our own religious institutions or our own churches. This is something that has ramifications for how we live in the world. And so Christianity is public truth. We believe this to be true of the way that the world is, and we believe that the gospel tells a better story than all of the false worldviews that are on display out in our world.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, folks, we're talking with Trevin Wax. We're talking with him about his newest book, This Is Our Time, Everyday Myths in Light of the Gospel. You can follow Trevin on Twitter at Trevin Wax. Let's talk about those myths. I want you to talk about the myth of progress and the myth of decline in terms of the history of the world.
Well, a lot of people live by the myth of progress. That's this idea that we are becoming a more scientific and technologically advanced society. And as we continue to evolve into a higher consciousness, humanity is getting better and better, right? That we're shedding these silly, superstitious, religious rituals of the past, and we're moving forward into this more secular utopian future. This is the dominant worldview on most university campuses, right? That this is the myth of progress, and you do find people upset when they find that myth being challenged. On the other hand, you also have a myth of decline, and this can actually take place. Sometimes Christians think that the way we are to meet the myth of progress is with the myth of decline, that we would take this idea that the world is getting worse and worse, that we are just on our way to the worst possible moral state that we could have ever been in. That may be true at some level in one country or another, particularly here and there, but we have to consider other parts of world history where things have been many times much worse. And Christians tend to think about the myth of decline because they get nostalgic for some sort of era in the past where they feel things were better than they are now, whether it's the early church, whether it's the period of the church fathers, the Reformation, the revival periods, the growth of evangelicalism in the 1950s, whatever it might be, we find some pinnacle that we think we have fallen from. And what I want to say is, no, both of these are myths. As Charles Dickens said, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. That is true of all times, because God is always at work. There's always a broken, fallen world that we are living in. Redemption is real. There are signs of progress. There are signs of hope from a Christian standpoint. And then there are signs that would cause us to mourn, the kind of Christian tears that Jesus talks about in the Beatitudes. I want to shatter both of those myths so that we can actually have gospel bearings when we feel like the world is shifting under our feet.
I like the image of gospel bearings. Trevin, one of the things that we talk about here on the Reconnect from time to time are those good old days. And I'm constantly reminding people that there was only one time when things were good, genuinely good, declared as good. And you got to go all the way back prior to the fall if you want to talk about the good old days. And so anything post-fall can't be the good old days, because the good old days were way back when God declared things to be actually good. So we agree with you here on both the myth of progress and the myth of decline, and I thank you for putting it in those terms for us. Tell me what you, how do you hope that Christians are going to respond to the book, to the material in it, to the challenge that you present in This Is Our Time?
Well, you know, I'm really excited about this, because I wrote this book for just common Christians. I wanted Christians, you don't have to have a seminary education to read it. I actually, at my life group at church, I printed out chapters ahead of time as I would finish them, and I would hand them out to people in my life group, and they would mark on the pages, each page, they would give me a number based on how interesting they thought the page was. Or if I was losing them anywhere because I wasn't explaining myself well, they would give me numerical rating. And the reason I did that is because I really cared that people would read the stories in this book, read the examples in this book, the testimonies that are there, but also some of the theology that's baked in, and that they would find it to be an interesting read that is not too over their heads, that gives them a sense of, okay, I know that there are going to be challenges, and there are some things that I haven't even thought about when it comes to things like, you know, my shopping habits, you know, that I want to be faithful in all these different areas of life. And I'm excited that the book is out, because I hope that Christians will feel more equipped to be faithful in the time that God has called us in.
Okay. I love that. All right, friends, the book is entitled This Is Our Time, Everyday Myths in Light of the Gospel. The author is Trevin Wax. But in addition to being the author of this book, Trevin actually has a day job at Lifeway Christian Resources. And they've published a new Bible. Well, it's not a new Bible. It's a new translation of the Bible. You'll have to set me straight here. The Christian Standard Bible. Trevin, you're going to have to make a good argument here for why I should give up my 1981 NIV or my ESV for the new CSB. So go, man.
Well, I wouldn't want you to have to give up another Bible that you love. I have used multiple translations over my life, and I'm grateful for them all. But what I will say about the CSB that is very exciting to me is, you know, when I was on staff at a church, I would often use a more formal translation, a more word-for-word translation when I would teach and preach. But then I would hand out a more dynamic, a more thought-for-thought, very easy to read translation. And it always frustrated me that I never felt like one of those did both of those well, you know?
Mm.
Like I wanted to have one translation that would be a sort of my default, that I knew would be solid for me to preach and teach from, good for Bible study, word for word that I can study and at the same time be easy to understand in contemporary English. And the CSV for me has the best of multiple translations that I love. It's more readable than the ESV, but it is more literal than the NIV. So it's in that sweet spot for me where when I use this translation, I can really see how it works in multiple places for multiple purposes. And so I'm very excited to see how the church responds to it. I think it's going to be, it's a beautiful translation. Michael Carr did the styling, the singer-songwriter. It's a translation I think that people are going to find is helpful devotionally when they read on their own, but also pastors and scholars and teachers are also going to go to because they see how accurate it is.
All right, fantastic. I have one more personal question for you, and that's about being a missionary to Romania. And I know that your father-in-law is Romanian. He actually figures in the book at the beginning and the end. So I had the opportunity to have a mission experience in Romania in December of 2001. I would just tell us what your heart for those people is.
You know, I took mission trips over there as a teenager, and the Lord just really worked on my heart during those years as a teenager. And then when I was 19, I bought a one-way ticket. I moved there. I lived there for 5 years. I learned the language, did my undergrad work there, worked in village churches. I met my wife there. Since we've come back to the States, I feel like I've brought some Romania home, obviously, because of her and her family coming to visit at times. And, the Romanian people, I think the reason my heart feels so close to this particular people is because of the years that they went through the communist regime and watching the faithfulness of Christians during an era where it was very difficult to be a Christian. Being able to serve people coming out of that time of communism, beginning to grapple with the different challenges, but very real challenges of freedom and of economic prosperity and things like that. There will always be a place in my heart for Romania because of just how God has worked in my heart to serve those people and then how much I have been served by them as well.
I love it, folks. That is a shout out for international mission experiences when our children are young, that we need to expose them to how the church is functioning around the world and the places in the world where we can be a blessing to others, and then how we can go be a student of other Christians in other parts of the world. Trevin, thank you so much for the new book. This is our time. Thank you for the new Bible translation, Christian Standard Bible. Thank you for your work in Romania, and thank you for your partnership in the gospel. Thanks for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be with you.
Thanks a lot. All right, friends, it's time to go below the fold. I made a promise to my football-loving friends who have something happening this weekend called the Combine, which I got to tell you, from being from a farm family in Indiana, a Combine is it's a machine. And so the Combine for football players is an activity that they are going to be engaging in. And so I grabbed a football story today. And so the person who's listening, who knows it's for them, is probably smiling right now. All right. My football story for today is Colin Kaepernick. Now, I told Colin Kaepernick's story back many months ago when, oh, good heavens, he refused to stand for the national anthem. It started out as like a sitting protest, sitting on the bench, and then it evolved into a kneeling protest, which really, I'm not sure how kneeling is as strong a protest as sitting, but I understand why he moved from sitting to kneeling, because he wanted to be really clear what he was protesting and what he was not protesting. But let me put it this way, because he now wants a new job and because he's trying to make himself marketable to other teams, he's now a free agent, by the way, as of today, he said, well, you know what? I'm done with that particular protest. So you can count on me to stand for the national anthem and not run the risk of running afoul of many of your fans in your franchise. So, you know, we don't want to offend the fan base in a new franchise home city. And so
we're going to basically say, this is Colin Kaepernick, we're going to basically say, you know what, that thing that I was protesting, well, I wasn't actually protesting the thing, because the thing hasn't really come to an end, but I made my point. I started the conversation. I got the conversation going. Okay, so what I'm going to lift up to you is this. You got to be careful what you take a stand for, because once you take a stand, people are going to expect you to take the stand. And if your stand is that you're not going to stand and then you start standing, people are going to sniff that out. All right? If you commit to take a stand, then stand. And if your stand is that you're not going to stand, then don't stand. Because once you do stand, we're going to all see that you're standing when you said you weren't going to stand. That was your stand. All right, I know. I've probably lost half the people that are listening. But when you take a stand, I want you to consider this. How long am I willing to stand for the thing that I have chosen to stand for? When it comes to the Christian faith, there's no sitting down for the one for whom we are taking a stand. I'm going to lift up a passage from the sixth chapter of the book of Ephesians. And when I called this scripture to mind the other day in our conversation with Congressman Chris Smith, who asked us to pray basically to bind the enemy that is activating the resist movement in ways that are just diabolical, I lifted up this text from Ephesians chapter 6, but I didn't read it to you. And I lifted it up in the context of spiritual warfare. Today, I want you to listen expressly for the word stand and how God calls us to take our stand. Ephesians chapter 6, beginning at the 10th verse. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God. Why? So that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God. Why? So that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. And after you have done everything, to stand. Stand firm, then, with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, with the breastplate of righteousness in place, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, and pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the saints. Friends, God's telling us, man, you got to stand. And once you stand, you keep standing. You stand firm. And when you can't stand anymore, when frankly you feel like sitting down, when frankly you feel like taking a break from the game, what does God say? After everything else, stand. In the Old Testament, some of the language related to taking a stand is this: stand, and I will stand you. See, when you and I take a stand for God, when we stand on the word, when we stand up for righteousness, when we stand for purity, when we stand for holiness, when we stand for truth, we don't do that on our own. God's actually the one who stands us up. How do I know that? Because, man, that is what I have experienced in my own life. You and I are called to put on the full armor of God every day. And we're called to put on Christ. And I just want to say this. None of that is supposed to be a put on. That is supposed to be our covering for who we become and what we are called to do, which is to stand in the world on his behalf. Why? Because, man, he is standing for us. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. It's been a great week to be with you. I look forward to seeing you right back here on Monday. Go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and grab the resources we've posted for you on the Shack. Have a great day, great weekend, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.